It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Obama is working to expand paid sick leave for American workers. We'll talk to an expert on employment law about how that could affect employees.
First, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has been in the news lately, laying out his priorities for the upcoming legislative session in Wisconsin. On the list, Voss is calling for closer scrutiny of UW faculty teaching loads.
Now, he says he supports research that ultimately helps Wisconsin's economy. He's got concerns, though, about the teaching loads of UW faculty and the kinds of research produced at the university. Voss has also been critical of the university tenure system.
Voss's concerns could have implications for Wisconsin's university system, one of the largest public higher education systems in the country.
Here to give us a professor's perspective is Tim Rogers. He's a professor in the psychology department at the UW-Madison, where he's the principal researcher at the Knowledge and Concepts Laboratory. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, looking at the question of direct teaching loads, take a full-time professor. How much time do most tenured professors spend actually teaching?
It depends what you call teaching. If you only count coursework, I spend typically about 2 full days out of the week preparing and delivering lectures and doing other sort of duties related to coursework particularly. Of course, the teaching mission of faculty at the university extends pretty far beyond just conducting classes.
So what other things would be involved in the teaching department for a professor?
Well, one of the things that sets UW apart from just a straightforward teaching university is, of course, that a lot of teaching occurs in a research context. The classes that we teach, I really view as providing a solid foundation of knowledge for our students. But the things that really provide great job opportunities for the graduates of UW-Madison and the rest of the UW system is the kind of knowledge that you get by applying those foundations to solving real-world problems. And the places where students actually learn to do those applications is in conducting real research in laboratories.
And so how much does that happen? How much of your week or one's week, and I'm sure it varies from professor to professor and school to school, but how much of a week is spent doing that kind of activity?
The kinds of load that we have during a given week is about equally split between teaching activities, research activities, and service activities. There's quite a lot of pragmatic sort of nuts and bolts aspects of science that are really done by faculty editing journals, reviewing papers, sitting on grant panels, writing grants, and so on and so forth. So it's about a 3x3x3 split.
Now, looking at what a professor does from the outside, we heard some of what Representative Voss has been looking for. He's not alone. There's a lot of expectation that the main thing a professor does is educate the students in the classroom. I mean, is there something fair to that? Is that maybe should that be a bigger part of the mission for a lot of faculty?
Well, I think it's short-sighted in both an economic standpoint and also from a teaching standpoint. So from an economic point of view, I think what some people fail to appreciate sometimes is that we're able to really attract the best and brightest minds from across the United States and also across the world to come and live and work here because the UW system strikes a real balance between teaching and the research mission. People who are good at advancing the state of science, good at generating new knowledge, come here to work partly because they know that the university is supporting the research mission. And when they come here, they don't do that research in a vacuum. Their research is generally supported by external grants from the federal government and also from private industry. And those federal grants both support the bottom line of the university itself, and they also create jobs here in Wisconsin. So, for instance, if I get a grant from NIH, a little north of 50% of it goes straight back to the university. Of the remaining 47%, by far the biggest line item in my grants is providing support for graduate students. We pay their salary, their benefits, and their tuition, another chunk that goes back to the university, and also hiring research staff at the university and postdoctoral research associates. So if you give the message that the UW system isn't really that interested in pursuing research, the people who bring in that grant money, which far outweighs the cost of their own salary and benefits in many cases, will look to move elsewhere, and they'll take that grant money and those jobs with them.
And presumably part of the workload is applying for those grants and doing the required updates for the grant makers and that sort of thing.
Absolutely. It's a huge amount of work to generate a grant. These are documents that are typically 50 to 60 pages long and spell out often programs of research that extend for 4 or 5 years into the future.
So another critique we've heard from the legislature, Representative Voss in particular, is that the research going on at the UW system doesn't always benefit the state economically. It doesn't have a direct line to economic development in the state. How would you answer that?
Yeah, I actually find that sort of puzzling coming from, a state party that's so invested in small government. The message seems to be that the people who are best suited to determining what research ought to be done is the state government. And that seems to be sort of against the general message that the government should be micromanaging the kinds of research that we do. If you're a scientist, there's really three career paths that you can take. You can work for industry, where the research that you do will be mainly determined by the bottom line, what's going to make money in the short term. You can work for the government, where the research that you will do is going to be shaped by the ideology and the politics of the party in power. And there's one place where you can go where the only thing that's really shaping the research is what knowledge, in the view of scientists who have expertise in the domain, we really need to sort of advance the state of knowledge, and that's in the university setting. The people who do research in a university setting are really just doing it for the scientific value. And so I think it would be a very short-sighted move to have government interference in shaping which way that research should go.
Well, here's a huge question. There's been a lot of ink and talking spilled on it, but maybe you could sum it up. What is the value of that kind of research? Research set where the agenda is set by scientists fulfilling curiosity, not necessarily looking for a direct benefit, a direct practical outcome.
Yeah, well, if you look back over the last 50 years of technological development in this country, I think that you'll see that many of the key innovations that have really driven the American economy forward and the knowledge economy forward was developed in a sort of public research context. You think about things like the internet, which was really developed by scientists who wanted to have better ways of communicating the results with one another. Any research that's done at a public university gets published in a journal that's really accessible to anybody in the country. Research that's done in a private context, of course, becomes proprietary and is often sort of held in a black box that nobody else can see. So while it's sometimes not immediately clear what the benefit of any given research program is, the people who are actually generating this new knowledge make it publicly available, where it then can be put into use by industry and the public sector.
Now, people in the public might look at the university and say, yes, we're glad the system is there. We like the work it does. We're happy to send our kids there. But we're spending our tax money there. We're spending our tuition money to send our kids there. We just want to make sure that it's being well used, that our investment is being well served. Do we have that kind of accountability in place where people can rest easy?
Oh, absolutely. So one of the many duties that you have as a faculty member is reviewing and mentoring the faculty who are coming up through the tenure process, which at UW-Madison is a very rigorous tenure process. It's a 7-year process. You get reviewed in our department every year. And the teaching and research mission are sort of weighted equally in these tenure decision processes. So there's already a lot of internal oversight over those kinds of things. I should also add that There's not really a cost in many cases to the research that's being done at the university. If I bring in a grant that supports many times my salary in both indirect costs back to the university and in employment, then the taxpayers aren't losing anything by hiring me here. I'm bringing the money into the university. But if I can't do the research that is really my part of my job statement, I guess, you know, I would be inclined to go somewhere else where I can do that research. All those grant dollars go along with me.
Briefly, as we wrap up, how do you see the university system contributing to the overall quality of life, measured economically or not, here in the state?
Well, that is another really critically important part, I think. Everybody who lives in Madison, at least, has met someone who came here as a student to get a great education, realized what a wonderful state and city it is, and ended up deciding they wanted to have a career here. Innovators who want to start new businesses and want to do it in a climate where there's the intellectual capital that they can exploit to have a good sort of workforce can do it here in Madison because there's so much cutting-edge research and because we attract the best and brightest faculty and also students from across the country. I think all of those things go to improving the quality of life in the state and also to developing its economy.
Tim, thanks a lot for joining us.
My pleasure.
That's Tim Rogers. He's a psychology professor at UW-Madison, principal researcher at the Knowledge and Concepts Laboratory. First, Latino immigrants to Wisconsin are raising concerns about Republican efforts to halt the immigration order President Obama issued late last year. Some are saying that the actions in Congress and the courts could hurt the GOP in next year's elections. Chuck Kornbach reports.
At Candelas Hall in Milwaukee on the night of November 20th, audio speakers hooked to a television set were turned up so all in the Latino-oriented club could hear the president issue his immigration order, including this provision.
If you've been in America for more than 5 years, if you have children who are American citizens or legal residents, if you register, pass a criminal background check, and you're willing to pay your fair share of taxes, you'll be able to apply to stay in this country temporarily without fear of deportation.
Immigration advocates generally welcomed the president's words, and nearly 2 months later, many Latinos still backed the Obama plan. At the Milwaukee office of the advocacy group Voces de la Frontera, volunteer and local university student Elizabeth Perez talks about how the immigration order would help her family. Perez was born in Mexico and brought to California at age 4 when her parents came to the U.S. illegally. Perez came out of the shadows a couple years ago when the president deferred deportation of some children of undocumented residents. Now she'd like her mom and dad to feel safe in the U.S.
Just driving my siblings to school or going to work, something that they have to do to support our family, just like any other family has to support their kids. They could do it without fear.
But in recent weeks, Perez has started to worry about criticism of the president's immigration order.
The gentleman will suspend.
Yesterday, the Republican-controlled House of Representatives approved a bill that would eliminate funding for the Obama plan. South Carolina lawmaker Trey Gowdy derided the president's order.
He declared unilaterally that almost 5 million undocumented aliens will receive deferred action under some newfangled definition of prosecutorial discretion, Madam Speaker.
It's unclear if the Senate will go along with the defunding, and even if the measure passes, a White House veto is thought likely. But Wisconsin Republican Senator Ron Johnson says he'll still push for the bill.
You know, I'm not trying to pick a fight. That fight was picked, and all I'm trying to do is make sure that as much as possible we defend Congress's role.
The defunding bill is not the only attack on the immigration plan. Today in Texas, there was court action aimed at blocking the executive order. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker is part of that lawsuit against the president.
In this country, you don't get to just move because you're frustrated with the timeline of the Congress, no matter what party's in charge.
Walker claims not to be worried about Latino voters being upset with him if his run for president continues. Contending Latinos also back candidates who expand school vouchers and help the economy. But Milwaukee Democratic State Representative Jocasta Zamarripa, who has the largest Latino constituency in Wisconsin, says Congress could have passed immigration reform years ago and still ought to act, as there are another 5 million undocumented residents not covered by the president's order. Zamarripa says more young Latinos will soon be voters and remember the conservatives' attack on the executive action.
We need to have elected officials that are responding to the concerns of this growing young electorate, and I hope that we'll have a real influence on the presidential election in 2016.
Details of President Obama's immigration plan are expected soon, even as Latinos wait to see what happens in the courts and Congress. Chuck Kornbach, Wisconsin Public Radio.
In an announcement from the White House today. President Obama is asking for expanded paid sick leave for workers across the United States. He asked Congress to pass the Healthy Families Act, which would allow workers to accrue up to 7 days of paid sick leave per year. And he's trying to pave the way for states and cities to pass similar laws.
Marsha McCormick is here to break down this new idea for us. She's a professor and the director of the Weifel Center for Employment Law at the St. Louis University School of Law. Marsha, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what does the president want to accomplish when it comes to paid family and sick leave?
Well, I think that the president wants to ensure that the large number of people who currently don't have paid sick time have access to it, and that they are free to actually take the leave when they need it.
How does the U.S. compare to other developed countries when it comes to areas like this, paid sick and family leave?
Well, we are probably the only industrialized nation that does not provide for any sort of paid family leave, and we are one of the very few that doesn't provide for pretty generous family and sick leave.
Let's talk some about the Healthy Families Act. It was introduced several years ago. What's in it, and why is the president bringing it back now?
I think the president is bringing it back now because actually this act, although it hasn't passed Congress, even though it's been introduced a number of times, is widely supported. By some estimates, the provisions within it are supported by about two-thirds to three-quarters of voters. Especially given the flu season we've had, it might actually be really good timing since sick leave is on people's minds.
And tell us a little bit more about what's inside that Healthy Families Act.
Yeah, so the act provides for a system by which employees could earn hours of sick leave up to 56 hours, or essentially seven full-time types of days of leave for every 30 hours they have worked. And that's the extent of it, essentially the primary portion of it. But it also provides for some additional things. It allows people to take that leave that they would earn if they were ill with an ordinary illness or injured, if they had some kind of preventive care appointment, just going to a regular doctor appointment, if they have to take someone else in their family, including a child, anyone else they take care of, an older person they take care of, including their own parent or a parent-in-law, to some kind of doctor's appointment, or if that person is simply sick and needs some support. It also would allow people to take the leave if they are victims of domestic or sexual violence and need to access care because of that, or need to access some kind of legal help for that or pursue a legal remedy. And then finally, the legislation would provide that employers wouldn't be allowed to penalize people for taking this leave. So they wouldn't be able to terminate someone because they took the sick leave. They wouldn't be able to deny the sick leave that someone had earned, but they also wouldn't be able to count absences taken under the sick leave, even if they have a general policy of taking absences into account in deciding who to retain and who to fire.
Congress passed the Family and Medical Leave Act in 1993. How does the Healthy Families Act grow on that? What are the big differences?
Well, there are a lot of big differences. So the Family and Medical Leave Act only covers about 40% of the workforce. Basically, it only covers people who work enough hours, and it only covers people who work for employers who have at least 50 employees. The Healthy Families Act covers many more employers. It would cover any employer that had at least 15 employees. So much smaller employers than the Family and Medical Leave Act does. In addition, the Family and Medical Leave Act leave is not paid, and so it's difficult to take it if you are, especially if you're a lower wage worker or your employer doesn't provide some sort of pay along with that kind of leave. Finally, the Family and Medical Leave Act only covers absences due to a serious health condition or a chronic health condition, in addition to caregiving leave. And so a serious health condition is defined as basically having to miss 3 calendar days of work, which is very different from the kind of hourly sick leave that the Healthy Families Act is designed to cover. It's also, the Family and Medical Leave Act can't be used for routine health care unless it's connected to some sort of chronic health condition.
Now, the president wants states and cities to take this up, to pass laws similar to the Healthy Families Act, and he wants Congress to spend a couple billion dollars to help them do that. Why pursue this at a state level instead of a federal level?
Well, there are a lot of good reasons to focus on the state. So for one thing, we do have a lot of state laws that mirror our federal laws. So, for example, in the discrimination context, all but three states also prohibit discrimination on the same basis as the federal government does. But the states have experimented a little bit more. They provide protection for different groups than the federal law does. And so states have more flexibility to cover smaller employers, for example, to tailor the system to fit their more local needs. And this would be true for cities as well. In some places, 7 days of sick leave might not seem appropriate, might not seem like enough for the particular conditions in that state or in that city. And so states are sort of being encouraged to experiment with options that might be more appropriate. There's one sort of additional piece to this, and that is that mandating that employers provide the leave may not be the only way to encourage having this kind of safety net for workers and protect the public health. We might want some kind of an insurance system set up, like unemployment insurance, where employees might pay in, employers might pay in, and the state might pay in to help protect people for taking longer leave. And that's something that's really administered most appropriately at the state level.
We're talking right now to employment law expert Marcia McCormick about President Obama's plan to expand paid sick leave for American workers.
And we want to hear your thoughts and your experiences. How do sick leave, family leave work at your job? Have you ever lost a job or a promotion because of an illness? Do you think expanded paid sick leave is a good idea? If you're an employer, what do you think of all this? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our discussion with employment law expert Marcia McCormick about President Obama's plan to expand paid sick leave for American workers.
And we're taking your calls. Do you think expanded paid sick leave and family leave is a good idea? How does sick leave work at your job, family leave? Business owners, how would expanded paid sick leave affect your bottom line and your workflow? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We've got Daniel on the line in Milwaukee. Hi, Daniel.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good, thanks.
So first thing I want to say, well, I guess glossing over however many millions of dollars the couple billion dollar plan will cost Wisconsin taxpayers, I think like the government has an issue understanding the human condition when they're spending money on these things. A good employer will give sick people time off and they won't lose their jobs. A terrible employer will fire people for taking time off. And that's not going to change if the government makes them give them time off. They'll just find something to fire them with. You know, you clocked in too early too many times, too late too many times. You're not productive enough, whatever. The bad people who shouldn't be employers will continue mistreating employees. Doesn't matter who's forcing them to do what.
Great. Well, thank you for your perspective, Daniel. Appreciate that. And Marcia, what do you think about that thought? Is it possible that this will not fix the problem in the way that the president wants it to?
Well, it is possible that it won't fix the problem quite the way the president wants to, I suppose. And these sort of free market arguments are very popular against a lot of workplace legislation. I guess the sort of response to that, to some extent, is that, you know, if the market could really fix this, then in some places 40% or more of the workforce would have sick leave, and we would have run the bad employers out of business. So I think there are a lot of employers who need an incentive and need to understand how to make it work to provide this kind of leave, and that the legislation might help do that.
Now, to get at this from a business owner's perspective, a lot of smaller businesses in particular may feel under pressure already from the Affordable Care Act and new costs there. And with minimum wage hikes in some cities, is this too much at once? Is it going to put too much of a burden on small businesses?
It might feel like a lot of burden because they're each a different thing. But one of the interesting things I think about this particular legislative solution is that, one, the number of hours that need to be paid is limited, first of all. And second of all, it's also made proportional to the number of hours the person actually works. And so part-time people, people who don't work a lot of hours at some of these businesses, are not going to earn the number of sick leave hours potentially that a full-time worker would. So that's going to, one, make this more affordable. Second, really small employers under 15 employees are not going to be covered. And so it's only employers of 15 employees or more, which those employers probably could absorb the extra hours of pay, even in addition to some of these other costs.
And what about the prospect of this cutting into the bottom line, into wages for workers? It comes out there if sick leave happens earlier down the line.
Well, yeah, that's a good point as well, that this is one more benefit that isn't going directly to the bottom line into workers' paychecks. But overall, the amount that it might reduce wages, 7 days over the course of a year or 56 hours over the course of, however many hours a full-time person works in the year, seems relatively minute. We're not talking about, a dollar less, even an hour, that a person's going to be paid. We're talking about cents less an hour at most. So in the aggregate, it might sound like a lot, that 7 days, but it can't have the effect that that some people are predicting, I think.
We'll go back to our phone lines now. We've got David with us from Onalaska. Hi, David.
Hello. I don't think that this is the president's job, is to mandate employers provide sick pay. I think that, a president's job is to keep our country safe and, make sure that we have a relatively good economy so individuals can go out and, compete either in work or in whatever they want to do. And if an employee is not satisfied with his or her benefits, then it's up to that employee to get further training, go back to school, do whatever they have to do to improve their own condition. And that includes looking for an employer that may provide that benefit if that's what they really want.
David, thanks a lot for your call. Appreciate that. And Marcia, what about David's argument there that this is too much government oversight where it's not needed?
Well, that's interesting. And I think he made a slightly different point than the prior caller about the level of government oversight, and that is the role of the president in doing it. And I think one thing is easy to misunderstand here is that the president didn't mandate the Healthy Families Act go into effect. What he did was say the rules are changing within the executive branch, and that was what his memorandum was about. And then he encouraged Congress to pass legislation that is in Congress. And so this is about Congress legislating, and that to the extent that it really is still about government government regulation, again, I guess I'd say if the market was going to fix it, the market would have fixed it.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. As we talk about the president's initiative to get states, cities on board with something like a Healthy Families Act and provide for 7 days of paid sick leave per year. And Marcia, let's talk a little bit about the president's memorandum to federal employees. What did he do?
He basically said that federal employees would get paid family time, actually. He increased the federal employees who would get paid sick leave, but also provided that federal employees would get paid family leave care. And so his memorandum is much closer to something like what the Family and Medical Leave Act covers rather than what the Healthy Families Act does. So he's acting on in two related areas. One, caregiving leave, especially longer-term caregiving leave, and then also short-term, one-hour-at-a-time kind of sick leave.
Now, some people say that the push for more comprehensive family and medical leave policies are the next wave of feminism. Former Vermont Governor Madeleine Cunin has said this. Why is this often considered a woman's issue?
Well, historically, it has been a woman's issue, which is actually a little bit, which is the genesis for the Family and Medical Leave Act. Historically, women have been caregivers, and there's been this sort of cycle or, I don't know, recursive effect where because women are historically caregivers, they aren't considered real workers, and so they don't get offered the jobs, or they don't choose jobs unless they think those jobs will give them flexibility. And so we have this sort of cycle of women remaining caregivers. And that deprives men who are awesome caregivers of having the flexibility to be the ones who provide caregiving within their families. And it deprives women who want to have more of a stake at the workplace. And so family and medical leave, by sort of providing it for everyone, men and women, the idea is that some of those stereotypes will break down.
We'll go back to our callers now. We've got Jared joining us in Green Bay. Hi, Jared.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have to admit, I'm a little bit annoyed with some of the callers, you know, saying how the market will fix this and this isn't the president's issue and they should just find better jobs. Those jobs don't exist. And whenever I hear this, I always feel like there's a lack of perspective because in the earlier part of the 20th century, it was terrible. We had robber barons, like people were literally killed over striking, and then we had unions. And so, and then over time, those unions have been slowly dismantled and workers' rights are like being slowly eroded. And these laws exist for a reason. They're not a what if. We know what happens when workers aren't adequately protected. We've seen it before. It's terrible. Thank you.
All right, Jared, thank you for that. And Marcia.
Yeah, it is interesting. We've definitely come a long way since the early parts of the 20th century, and the fact that we have is often being used as an excuse for why we don't need workers' rights. So I think it's an interesting development.
We've heard some different perspectives today on the president's push for this leave, this paid sick leave. What kind of buy-in will he get, do you think, from states and cities around the country?
That's an interesting question because there are three states right now that mandate paid sick leaves for their employees. But there are efforts at other states. The fact that the president has started encouraging it and has asked Congress to help with funding may speed those efforts along.
Marcia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
That was Marcia McCormick, professor and director of the Weifel Center for Employment Law at the St. Louis University School of Law.
First, do you have too much stuff? Are you too attached to the things you own? Maybe you're feeling cluttered after the holidays. Our next guest has some advice. Get rid of one thing every day of the year.
And we want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Have you made an effort to cut down, to simplify, to get rid of some of the stuff that you've got sitting around? Or do you have a hard time parting ways with your possessions? Do you get attached? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Danny Heitman joins us now. He's a columnist at the Baton Rouge Advocate, and his column on this topic is linked on our Central Time Facebook page. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Welcome back, Rob and Veronica, and happy 2015 to you.
And to you, too. Well, what started getting you thinking about clutter and possessions?
I put away my Christmas decorations last month and really enjoyed the extra space in the house after the Christmas stuff was put away, and it made me think about what other space I might be able to reclaim in my house and my life if I got rid of some other things in the house. And I'm not really what people would call a pack rat. I'm not one of those folks that would end up on a hoarding reality show. But nevertheless, like most folks, I probably keep more things than I need to. And it occurred to me that if I just got rid of one thing every day, that by next Christmas, my life would probably be a little bit simpler. So that's what I've been doing. I've been giving away one thing a day. I have a little giveaway pile at the near my front door, and I put one thing there every day. And then I record that in a journal. I'm actually keeping track of it through the year, not only recording what I give away, but what I actually bring into the house, what I acquire. And I'm hoping that by writing it down that I'm going to be actually more mindful of the things in my life that I don't need, as well as the things of my life that I'm bringing in. I'll be a little bit more reflective on what my actual needs are.
What kind of stuff have you given away so far?
Everybody has their weaknesses, I think, for acquiring things. And I am not a champion shopper, but my weakness is books. I'm a big reader, and I enjoy my reading life. and would not give that up. But nevertheless, I find I have many more books than I need. So every day, whenever I've put stuff on the giveaway pile, more than likely it's a book. However, I've taken, you know, the T-shirt out of my drawer that I'm not going to wear again. I've gotten a pair of pants out of the closet that I know I will never lose enough weight to fit into ever again. I've put that on the pile. A pair of shoes. Pretty much what most people would put on the giveaway pile if they were to really think about it. So that's how it's gone so far. My brother, Tim, when he heard about my resolution, said, you know, at first I thought that was crazy. I mean, 365 things by the end of the year that you're going to give away. And then it occurred to me that I have 30 shirts probably in my closet. That's a month's worth of giving away if you gave away one thing every day. So I could easily do that for a month. And I think most of us, if we think about how much stuff we have, we would find that it's probably pretty easy to give away one thing a day.
Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. We have Isaiah with us in Lac des Flambeaux. Isaiah, hi.
Hi. I think it's great that this was your New Year's resolution. In Lakota culture, as well as many American Indian cultures, if someone says that they like something of yours, it's your obligation sort of to give it to them in an effort to not have people covet things. And I think that's something that I try and live by, or at least trade them if they like it. And then the other thing I think is, in a community or a small community, a lot of times things that are yours aren't really yours. It's more of the community. So even though you might have a car, if your friend or relative needs it, you might have to lend it to them as part of just being able to survive in the community, realizing that some people have some gifts and some people have others, and we have a responsibility to share.
Isaiah, thanks so much. An interesting perspective, Danny. That's different than the way we often think of, well, our stuff, things that we possess, they belong to us.
I think that's a beautiful tradition that Isaiah mentioned. I would also mention another. I have heard that in Chinese culture, it is considered a good thing to spend, you know, half of your life acquiring things, and then the other half, as you reach midlife, slowly giving them away, so that by the end of your life, you've sort of reached an equilibrium. And now that I'm 50, I think about the wisdom of that, you know, that I really don't need all this stuff anymore. I don't have the hunger for it that I used to. And so at any rate, I really thank Isaiah for sharing that with us. That's a beautiful tradition.
It's interesting because you're at the beginning of this experiment. As the days go by, I wonder if it'll get harder and the stuff that you bring in will be in close balance with the stuff you're getting rid of. Do you have things that you know are going to be tougher to give away, but you're maybe prepared at this point at least to do it?
That is such a good question, and it really reminds me that I have started with the low-hanging fruit. I have started with the stuff that I know is pretty easy. You know, as I conclude breakfast each morning, I sort of look around and say, I can easily get rid of that. So I am not to the point where I'm giving till it hurts, but that is an interesting question to explore as I get further along in this experiment. And one thing we might consider is having me back in 3 or 4 months on your show and ask, hey, Danny, are you still keeping up with this resolution? How's it going?
Hold you to it, yeah. We're talking to Danny Heitman. He kicked off a resolution this month to get rid of stuff, specifically one personal possession every day. He's giving it away. Less clutter, more open space at home, maybe less need, less connection to material objects. Taking your calls too at 800-642-1234. Have you ever done something like this, made a big purge, or do you think you need to? Maybe need a little inspiration to make it happen. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. It's 800-642-1234. Danny, how do we fall into, even without planning in advance, how do we fall into accumulating so much stuff?
Well, E.B. White, who is a writer that I dearly love, he said without even trying, stuff comes into our house. We don't even have to go out and seek it. And he was really right. You know, he mentioned that people give us things with the best of intentions. Stuff arrives in the mail. We tend to acquire stuff thoughtlessly. We really don't think about the space it's going to consume in our house, the effort it's going to take to maintain it. I think most of us, including me, I think most of us are tend to be kind of thoughtless consumers. And so what I am trying to do by keeping a list of the things I give away, as well as the things that I acquire, I'm actually trying to create a shopping list in reverse. I'm creating a list of the things that I'm doing away with. I'm hoping that will make me more mindful. A woman who was a dietitian told me one time, and this is common advice to people who are going on a diet, write down everything you eat. And if you write down everything you eat, you will become to realize just how much you eat that you don't need to be eating. And I'm hoping if I write down what I acquire as well as what I give away, I am going to be more mindful and more intentional about the things I bring into my house.
Let's take another caller now. We've got Maria joining us from Eau Claire. Hi, Maria.
Hello. You know,
hi, Maria.
Twice in my life, I have literally given up everything, just given away, sold everything I owned, and didn't keep any more than I could put in the back of my car, and just, like, hit the road and just gone and done some other things. Now, granted, that was when I was in my 20s, but still, I mean, I had a house and furniture and everything, and I really feel like just having done that a couple of times in my life has just, now I'm in my 50s, and it's just completely changed my relationship to stuff. I just feel so much less attached. And, you know, when I look around my house now, I've been in the same house for years, and I'm astounded by how much stuff I have accumulated. But
Maria, I'm curious, since you've done this twice in your life, you kind of, you know, did the whole thing that that Danny's trying to do right now. How did it feel when you were heading off in your car, having gotten rid of everything? What did you feel like?
Well, at the time, it was always a very liberating feeling. It's almost kind of euphoric to just shed all that stuff. And I mean, I literally got rid of everything, furniture, everything, clothes. If I couldn't put it in the back of my car, that was gone.
Maria, thank you so much for sharing your story. Sounds like she's got some more stuff now, but Danny, that's what you have to look forward to, maybe euphoria when you get rid of enough of the stuff in your house, I guess. What do you think about Maria's story?
Well, it reminds me of, since I live here in Louisiana, it reminds me of how many people lost their possessions in Hurricane Katrina. And I do not want to diminish the profound sadness in that loss. It was really devastating. But I think what people here learned is that ultimately you are not defined by your possessions. You are not defined by what you own. And many of those folks who did get through that experience, I think came to realize that, you know, that does not really define your happiness. And so I salute Maria for doing that. And I think what her story also points to is the reality that this is a continuing challenge and a continuing struggle that we have. It's a first world problem, of course. It's a nice problem to have, this abundance of our consumer culture. But we never fully resolve it, do we? I mean, we're always struggling to simplify, as Thoreau implored us to do. And it's probably something I'm going to be dealing with as long as I live, and you'll be dealing with as long as you live.
So. Well, Danny, good luck to you, and thank you so much for joining us. Maybe we'll talk to you further down the road.
Thanks, and happy New Year to you.
And the same to you. That was Danny Heitman, columnist for the Baton Rouge Advocate. You can check out his column and share your thoughts on the Central Time Facebook page.